news, weather, truth, and fun. We're iHub Radio, homegrown in the Coachella Valley. For a fresh take on the news with Anita Rufus. You won't know if you don't listen.
And thank you so much for listening. This is Anita Rufus, the lovable liberal. And this is iHub Radio. I am here live on Saturdays from 10 to noon. And you can always get podcasts at the iHub website, iHubRadio.com. Today is May 2nd. Can you believe it's May? What happened to, like, January? Anyway, obviously, the virus is the thing everybody is talking about, and I will deal with a little bit about the virus today, but I have some other takes on this, some points of view about what's going on right now that I want to share. The blast I sent out this week talked about whether the essentials are also the expendables. And this is something I really want to get into because there have been some statements made and some policy decisions made about those we consider essentials, the people who are working in hospitals, the people who are driving ambulances, the people who are checking your groceries, the people who are delivering your food. And yet there is a question about those who are considered expendable in our society. So I'm going to get into that in a minute. But first, I want to start out by talking about Dr. Anthony Fauci. I just was so tickled early last week. There was a move to declare Anthony Fauci the sexiest man alive. You know how People Magazine always does the sexiest man alive? There was a petition out there, may still be circulating out there, to make Anthony Fauci People's Magazine's sexiest man alive. And then this morning, and by the way, polls have also shown that Anthony Fauci is trusted by the American people far more than our president, which cannot be making Donald Trump very happy. Well, this week, we just found out that this coming week, when Congress comes back to Washington, the House Appropriations Committee wanted to have Dr. Anthony Fauci come and testify. And the White House has said, no. May 6th is not an appropriate time for Fauci to go in front of the House. It would be to testify to some extent about the response to the coronavirus crisis, because the Appropriations Committee is the one that is supposed to oversee how money is being spent, and they want to talk to Anthony Fauci about our response overall so that they can assess whether or not money is being spent appropriately. The White House said it's counterproductive to have the very individuals involved in the efforts to curtail the virus or to deal with the virus. It's counterproductive to have those very individuals involved in appearing at congressional hearings. We are committed to working with Congress to offer testimony at the appropriate time. Well, interestingly enough, May 6th was not a date this coming week that they liked the idea of Anthony Fauci going in front of the House committee, because the House is run by Democrats. But amazingly enough, the following week, I believe on May 12th, they've now said, well, Anthony Fauci can go and testify in front of a Senate committee that wants to talk to him, because the Senate is run by the Republicans. So the White House obviously feels that the kinds of questions the House might ask, dominated by Democrats, might elicit some answers from Anthony Fauci that the White House might not like. You think? Fauci last testified about the virus in front of a House committee on March 11th, and that was when he warned, we will see more cases and things will get worse than they are right now. That testimony was cut short because he was almost immediately called to a meeting at the White House. Meanwhile, it's inappropriate to have this individual who is so involved testify at this time, but evidently they didn't feel it was inappropriate to have him standing on stage for more than 2 hours when Donald Trump was conducting his oversight briefings. Now, the thing I loved this past week, and by the way, let me just add, you do know that there have been moves to try and fire Anthony Fauci. Interestingly enough, it turns out the president and chief executive of something called the Partnership for Public Service, which is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization, said with regard to this move to try and fire Fauci, they can't just fire him. He's a career employee. Civil service protections were created precisely for this reason, to protect government employees from political retaliation. That doesn't mean the president hasn't politically retaliated against some people who are civil service employees, but usually what they can do is they take them out of their current position and move them to a different position. And this president has done that many times. Meanwhile, Fauci has led the infectious disease unit at NIH, the National Institutes of Health, since 1984 under presidents of both parties. Okay. This thing about sexualizing Anthony Fauci. And I'm sure his wife finds him sexy. But as it turns out, this last Saturday on Saturday Night Live, if you did not see the opening of that show, you missed one of the best, most classic things they've ever done. Because as it turns out, Brad Pitt was on the opening for Saturday Night Live playing Dr. Anthony Fauci. And it was brilliant and very funny. And heavily tongue-in-cheek. But as played by Brad Pitt in a gravelly voice with a New York accent that sounded a lot like Dr. Anthony Fauci, he said, a miracle would be great. Who doesn't love miracles? But miracles shouldn't be plan A. Even Sully, that heroic pilot, who landed that plane in the Hudson River or the East River, he said even Sully tried to land at an airport first. And he said when the president said everyone can get a test, what he meant was almost no one. So yeah, I'm getting fired. But until then, I'm going to be there putting out the facts for whoever's listening. And when I hear things like the virus can be cured if everyone takes the Tide Pod Challenge, I'll be there to say, please don't do that. And then at the end of his thing, right before saying it's Saturday Night Live, Brad Pitt pulled off the wig and made it clear that he was, in fact, Brad Pitt, playing Dr. Anthony Fauci. Well, what I thought was so cool about that, it turns out that at one point, Anthony Fauci was asked by a reporter, if somebody were going to play you in a movie or a documentary, who would you want it to be? And he said, Brad Pitt. I thought that was great. He said, I'm a great fan of Brad Pitt. And that's the reason when people ask me who I'd like to play me, I mention Brad Pitt. Because he's one of my favorite actors. He was asked after the Saturday Night Live portrayal whether he thought Brad Pitt did a good job, and he said, I think he did a great job. Listen, if the person I would most want to play me actually did play me, I would think they did a great job too. But I do want to share with you, with regard to trying to make Anthony Fauci the sexiest man alive in People magazine, There was an incredible column written by a terrific writer who does very clever tongue-in-cheek writing. Her name is Mary McNamara. And this column ran in the LA Times, and it was headlined, "Stop Trying to Make Anthony Fauci Sexy." She said, "For the love of God, can someone please tear up the petition to make Anthony Fauci the sexiest man alive? If not, can we at least stop talking about it?" I get it's a compliment. For some, heaven help us, it's the ultimate compliment. But she said, "Fauci's unflappable and highly competent demeanor has been a beacon of strength and surprise amid the squishy, tweet-driven, ass-covering, daily contradictory triumph of personal feelings over irrefutable facts that has been the Trump administration's reaction to this pandemic." She said, "Fauci will continue to stand in front of microphones talking only about the things he knows, not what he wants or what he wishes or what he thinks or what he feels, but what he knows." She said, "Do you think I'm overreacting? We need to resist the desire to humanize him by asking him for dating advice or making him more accessible by tarting him up with some pop culture makeover." She said, "There's already a bubblehead, a late night fan club, a prayer candle and socks. Can a reality show be very far behind?" She said, "If life is really going to look different in the coming months, let's begin with this. Let's not make Anthony Fauci a rock star, because he doesn't need to be a rock star. He needs to be what he is, a physician and expert immunologist who emerged from the AIDS crisis with a unique understanding of the relationship among science, humanity, and public policy. A man with the near miraculous power to separate his ego from his mission, to bring science to an avowedly anti-science presidential administration, to express expertise in front of a president who doesn't believe in experts." She said, "We have a chance to return expert culture to actual experts, as opposed to the media experts like Dr. Phil or Dr. Oz, who do their thing for ratings. With any luck, Fauci's expertise will not just save us from the pandemic, but will also remind us that there are times when expertise is the most important commodity." Three cheers to Mary McNamara. And the idea that we should make Anthony Fauci the sexiest man alive, I'm not sure I would go there. I admire him. I respect him. I have great admiration for him. But to be honest, at least in my estimation, I don't think Anthony Fauci is sexy. I'm glad his wife does. And I'm sure there are other people out there who would find him that. It's not my type. But nevertheless, I agree with the American people. He is much more to be admired and trusted at this difficult time than the President of the United States. This is Anita Rufus, the lovable liberal, on iHub Radio.
Live from Palm Springs, she calls it as she sees it. Local talk that's moving the needle. Here's Anita Rufus on iHub Radio.
And again, I thank you so much for joining me every Saturday live from 10 to noon with reruns at other times during the day. You can find when the reruns are going to run on iHub. Or you can find podcasts if you just go to the website, ihubradio.com. Also, if you'd like to get in on the conversation, the phone number here at the studio is 760-544-8255. 544-8255. You can text 760-699-0202, or you can email a question or a comment to studio@ihubradio.com, and we will be happy to respond. And it's okay if you don't agree with me. You know, one of the things, we're celebrating our second year of iHub Radio being on the air. This week is the second year. And I've been here since the beginning and very pleased to be part of iHub Radio, which is a great experiment in online radio as opposed to radio station radio. Among the things that I like about being here at iHub is John McMullen, who runs this, gives me the freedom to do it however I want to do it. And it means that I can have a relationship with the audience. And there are a lot of people, when I go out in the community, we are based here in the Coachella Valley near Palm Springs, and when I go out in the community, or in Palm Springs actually is where the studio is, I live nearby. When I go out in the community, there are a lot of people who listen to the show, never call in, but give me supportive comments. Like, I really appreciate when you talk about things that I wouldn't know if I didn't listen to your show, or when you do that segment called Watch What They're Doing instead of listening to what they're saying. And one of the things that I talked about yesterday on the air when John McMullen was celebrating our second anniversary, and he asked me if I would call in and talk about my time on the station. And he asked me about the fact that I never mind having comments from people who don't agree. And it's true. I don't call people names. And I will say that in the over 20 years that I've been on the air, I have had some people I wouldn't have minded calling names. Let me take a quick sip of my coffee brew because I'm getting hoarse. That's good. One of the things I do, though, with people who don't agree with me, and I do this in life, and part of it is because I am a trained mediator. And I've learned that the best way to deal with people who don't agree with you, and a lot of us are facing that right now in our political climate, the best way to deal with people who don't agree with you is to draw them out on what is informing their opinion. Because a lot of people who just throw out sound bites, political sound bites, something that everybody is saying on talk radio, or things that have been thrown out on Facebook or Twitter or whatever, a lot of people throw out those what are known as topic sentences. When we were studying English in school, a topic sentence was the paragraph usually starts with a sentence that explains what that paragraph will be about. But it doesn't always give you the nuances that you need to get if you read the whole paragraph. You can know what the paragraph is going to be about, but you won't understand what's backing that up or what the reasoning is behind it. And so when somebody is shouting out or spouting off about these sound bites, they often do not think through what is behind it or what supports it or what the implications of it are. And this is one of the things I've learned to do with people who don't agree with me. I want to understand where they're coming from and where perhaps there might be inconsistencies in the point of view they hold that they haven't thought through. The simplest version of this is when somebody says, well, I'm totally pro-life. I can respect that. I may not agree with it in political terms, but I can certainly respect that. I'm pro-life too. And yet I support the right for a woman to choose whether to continue an unwanted pregnancy, because I'm pro-life, the life that's already there, not the one that might be potential. That's my thinking about it. So when somebody will say to me, well, I'm totally pro-life, I always ask my first question, well, how do you feel about the death penalty? Because to me, the inconsistency in someone being staunchly pro-life but in favor of the death penalty is the kind of dichotomy that I don't think that person has thought through. And that's one way to at least have a conversation and get underneath those sound bites with somebody who does not agree with you. Okay, when we come back, I want to talk about the essentials and the expendables and what is going on worldwide about those who are least able to survive this virus. This is Anita Rufus, the lovable liberal, and you are listening to iHub Radio.
News, weather, and a couple of dozen loudmouths. This is iHub Radio. She calls it as she sees it. Now, here's Anita Rufus.
Okay, I have just sucked on a delicious wild cherry flavored lozenge, which I hope will help my throat. I don't know about you, but I'm one of those people who has to have anything that is even remotely medicine-like. I have to have it in a flavor that I like. I don't like mint. So when I go to the drugstore to get cough syrup, I always tell them to please make it the cherry flavored. Anyway, obviously I talk too much, which anyone who knows me will certainly validate, and my throat gets sore. Okay, I want to talk about the concept of the essentials and the expendables with regard to this virus and with regard to our society in general. Nearly a dozen states have begun tentatively reopening this past yesterday because the federal government said, okay, the shutdown order is no longer in effect. The president has decided to leave everything up to the governor so that he doesn't have to be held accountable. And there have been some real battles about reopening that have flared up in Illinois, in Michigan. In Michigan, did you see those pictures of those yahoos showing up with those enormous assault weapons at and trying to bust their way into the Michigan legislature because they want the government reopened? I've talked a lot in the last couple of weeks about how these protests have in fact been organized. They are political. The president said, you know, well, these are good people. They, you know, the governor of Michigan, that woman, the governor of Michigan should try and work with them to resolve some of the tension. These are good people. This is what he said in Charlottesville, if you will recall, about the same kind of people, I might add, who are carrying Confederate flags. Meanwhile, one of the states that is opening restaurants and businesses, Texas, they started their reopenings a day after they reported their highest death toll yet. The state of Nebraska, which has, the governor there has routinely avoided any kind of an order that tells people they have to stay home. The rate of infections from this virus in the state of Nebraska were up 84% last week over the previous week. So far as we know, about 16,000 of the dead are from having got the virus in nursing homes, and testing is still lacking to find out how many really out there died or got sick in nursing homes. But roughly 1/4 of our overall deaths are coming from nursing home residents and staff. Now, as of yesterday, we were well over a million cases in the United States, over 65,000 dead, their families grieving. Many times multiple members of a family have died. It is heartbreaking. And we still don't have adequate testing to find out how many cases are out there so that we can begin to put our attention where it needs to be, like nursing homes, like prisons. And of course, there are the meatpacking plants. I talked a lot about that last week with regard to the president using his order to tell meatpacking plants, his government authority, to tell meatpacking plants they had to be open. And that means that those essential workers are, in fact, being considered expendable because his order did not require any particular health considerations be taken into account by those companies. Yes, we recommend that they have a safe workplace. And in his executive order, the president made clear no liability would accrue on the companies. So whatever happens, they can't be sued for having put people in situations where it was inevitable that they would be exposed and potentially get the virus because adequate safety preparations weren't made. Now, some of the companies out there, these meat processing companies, are trying to take adequate precautions. Some of them aren't. So these essential workers are, in fact, being considered expendable. Now, with regard to statistics, in Florida, the Florida health officials have stopped putting out up-to-the-minute death statistics. And in fact, by law, the medical examiners in the state are supposed to put out those statistics. But the medical examiners putting out those statistics of how many people died of the virus, those numbers were often higher than the figures that were being provided by Florida's Department of Health. Well, we can't have that. How can we reopen and let people come to the beaches and let people do what they normally do when they come to Florida? How can we allow that if the numbers keep going up? The Department of Health in the state of Florida said that almost 35,000 people were tested positive and over 1,300 people have died from it as of Friday. How can the state justify reopening with those kinds of statistics? Well, they don't want to know the statistics. They just want to get back to business. And I can understand that too. Listen, states are in big trouble financially. And the federal government doesn't seem inclined to want to help them out. The Trump administration and major manufacturers here in America are pressing Mexico to keep factories open that supply parts to United States companies, even though workers in Mexico are getting ill. Look, unemployment and poverty is a worldwide issue. It is not just affecting our country or Europe or Mexico. By the end of the year, experts are saying that the wave of unemployment that this virus has brought could help send at least 500 million people into true destitution. It would increase global poverty for the first time since 1998. We have done so well at trying to eliminate poverty and true destitution around the world. And every year, we've been getting better and better and better at reducing the number of people who are living in abject poverty around the world. And this year, because of this virus, at least 500 million people will be forced into global poverty, and the rate will be raised for the first time since 1998. So even though we keep saying, and I think we generally mean it, that we're all in this together, some of us are more into this than others. I've already talked about the fact that the rich, you know, they're out there on yachts in the middle of the water, and they're going to their vacation homes, and they're getting everything supplied. And communities of color and low-income working families are bearing the brunt of this virus. And it is reflecting the racial and socioeconomic disparities of the cities where this disease is spreading, and the healthcare system. Because communities of color and low-income families don't have access to the same kind of healthcare that people with jobs that give health coverage or people with private health insurance. The poor, the working poor, communities of color, low income, they don't get that. Preliminary data from several large, big metro areas show that people of color are getting this disease far more than their percentage of the population, and they are dying at a much greater rate than their percentage of the population. Milwaukee County, Wisconsin, has 26% black residents, yet they account for almost half of all of the virus cases in Milwaukee County, and 80% of the deaths. They're 26% of the population and 80% of the deaths in this county in Wisconsin. In Michigan, African Americans make up a plurality of cases and deaths, 35% of the cases, 40% of the deaths. They're only 14% of the population in that state. Now, it's true that working poor communities tend to have more underlying health conditions, heart disease, diabetes, hypertension, and low-income areas have larger non-white populations and much less access to health care. Layoffs have already hit service industries the hardest, and that's where these essential workers generally work. And up to 35 million Americans of all colors and all areas, up to 35 million Americans could lose their health insurance as businesses continue to lay off workers. The number of uninsured Americans could spike to over 40 million people. And that is a level of lack of health care or access to insurance that has not been seen since before Obamacare became the law in 2010. Now, 23 million Americans could enroll in Medicaid, but there are still more than 5 million who will end up totally uninsured. So are the essentials also considered the expendables? I'm going to talk about that when we come back. This is Anita Rufus, the lovable liberal. This is about the role of immigrants in our culture. You're listening to iHub Radio.
Because you only think you know the truth. Striking blows against the corporate talk radio monolith in the Coachella Valley. iHub Radio. Participation encouraged, but not required. Here's Anita Rufus.
So I'm talking about whether the essentials, those people that we just can't do without right now, even though we're shut down, the food delivery people, the Amazon delivery people, the grocery store workers, obviously healthcare professionals, the first line, ambulance drivers, police, the essentials. I'm asking, are they also the expendables? Are we giving them enough support and help? Are we providing them with the kind of protective gear they need? Are those who we consider essential also, based on our policies, basically expendable? I read this morning something that I thought nothing could shock me anymore. Planning commissioner in the city of Antioch, California, a small town that is east of Oakland. This planning commissioner was fired after having said out loud what I know a lot of people think. But he said it out loud. He said, just as fires clear dead brush, the sick, old, injured should be left to meet their natural cause. I'm sorry, their natural course during the pandemic. As for the homeless and others who defile themselves, either by choice or other issues, the virus would fix what is a significant burden on society. Fired. This is somebody who should be put in public stocks out in the middle of the courtyard for everybody to come by and throw a rock at. But when it comes to immigrants, when it comes to the poor, even the working poor, people of color, who generally are the ones, for example, working at the meat plants, these are the people who are filling what we all think are essential jobs. How could we manage if, in fact, all the grocery stores closed and nobody was there to check us out? But if they are essential, are we also seeing them as expendable? And what about all those people in the nursing homes and in prisons where the numbers are staggering? And where we have not done adequate testing to know who's sick, who needs to be quarantined and separated out from the others so that everybody doesn't get sick. Now, when it comes to people whose jobs are vulnerable as a result of what's been going on, it turns out that 77% of the jobs in the range of $20,000 to $25,000 a year salary, 77% of those jobs are vulnerable. A lot of those people have already lost those jobs. They're struggling to even try and get unemployment. They're now 2 or 3 months behind in trying to pay rent. 55% of the jobs in the $25,000 to $30,000 a year range are vulnerable. Almost 40% of those in the $30,000 to $40,000 a year range are vulnerable. When you go above $40,000 a year, and particularly when you go above $70,000 a year, those jobs are not as vulnerable, and those are the jobs that generally are considered to also include the kinds of benefits that include health care. So other countries are protecting jobs. Why aren't we? we now have a staggering number of unemployment claims. In fact, in just 1 week, in the middle of March, more than 3 million people filed for unemployment, and the number now I know is at least 6 million. And this spike in claims, in almost no other country are jobs being destroyed as fast as here. Because throughout the world, governments are protecting employment. Workers keep their jobs, even in industries that are shut down. The government in those countries covers most of the wages through direct payments to employers, so that the wages are basically paid for the duration of the crisis. One example, in both the United States and in Britain, the government is asking restaurant workers to stay home. But in Britain, they're being given 80% of their pay, up to over $3,000 a month. And they're guaranteed to get their job back once the shutdown is over. Here in America, they're being laid off. They have to file for unemployment. They have to wait for the economy to start up again. And then they have to apply for a new job. In Europe, people will be able to return to work as if they had been on a long government-paid leave. Not here. Germany has a policy aimed at job retention in times of crisis. And they had an infrastructure in place to send workers home, with the state replacing most of their income. In America, as they lose their jobs, workers are also losing their health care, as I said. Well, guess what? In those other countries, they have health care provided to everyone. And I saw a wonderful article yesterday about the difference between two workers, one in England and one in America, who had both gotten the illness, had been hospitalized, had in fact been on a ventilator, managed to recover, and went home. The guy in Britain had absolutely no medical bill. The guy in America, thousands of dollars he owed the hospital. That is absolutely unacceptable, and none of us should be willing to have that be the way it is in our country. In America, as they're losing their jobs, they're losing their health insurance, they can't afford COBRA. People are dying in this country and will have no economic security in the future because we are not providing it as a culture. I personally find that absolutely heinous. This is Anita Rufus, the Lovable Liberal, and you're listening to iHub Radio.